Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled.
Film.
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Woo! Woo!
Woo!
Yeah, settle down there.
Woo!
Oh gosh. They're excited, listener, because this week it's Ollie's choice, and it's the film Lady Hawk, with an E on the end, just to make spelling all that weirder. So, I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. Abigail Bain is with us.
Hello.
And Oliver Bain is with us.
Hooray!
Normally, people would say no relation there, but there is relation. But let's move on.
Hooray!
So, Lady Hawk. Ollie, you picked it. Why?
Because I like it. It's one of my movies, and it kind of fits into my own personal criteria for what kind of things I choose for the podcast, which is things which are kind of good, but also kind of overlooked.
That weird.
I would argue that. Oh, sorry.
No, go on, Ab.
I would argue that that is the way you choose things in life.
Well, yes. I mean, I do have a policy of. Well, probably we'll talk about it later, but I tend to like movies which are little big movies.
Yeah, the underdogs that are not bad, but not, championed.
No, it's not even that. It's just movies which are kind of simultaneously big but also small. But later.
Paradoxes. No, we do like to champion the lesser known movies and just discover the world of cinema together and have a chat about it. But how did you come across Lady Hawk in the first place before you'd come to like it and recommend it to the rest of us?
I have absolutely no idea.
Just in the brain, it was just always there.
I must have watched it at some point on TV.
And then
It wouldn't surprise me if it was in our mum's mammoth video collection as well, just somewhere.
I don't think it is. I think I watched it at some point on TV, and then later I probably rented the DVD from a library or something and then bought it, and then just, yeah, Lady Hawk. And, from the director of Superman.
Which Superman? The original 60s Superman?
Superman the movie. Well, from the director and writer of Superman the movie. And quite a few cast overlap.
Well, we should have some of the details before we go any further into the what me and Abby were expecting. I like to mix up the order of spoiler filled. It's not me forgetting when we do what. It's literally I like to mix it up. So let's have the details of who's in Lady Hawk, if someone's got them up, and maybe the general synopsis, but don't go too far into it. Go.
Okay. Right. Lady Hawk. 1985 fantasy film, directed by Richard Donner and starring Matthew Broderick, Rutger Hauer, and Michelle Pfeiffer. A thief called the Mouse escapes the dungeons of medieval Aquila, setting in motion a chain of events that may save or destroy a beautiful woman and a brave captain.
Yes. And it involves a wolf and a hawk, and it's going to get spoiled pretty early on. So if you're like, "Oh, what is it about?" and you want to check it out, come back or don't come back. But there are going to be spoilers, as there are every time we get together and chat about a film. So, Abby, your expectations when Ollie said, "Watch this, will ya?"
This film sounds a little bit ropey, but once I saw the trailer, oh, it might have been a clip, I realised that it was a little bit better than what it sounded like it would be, or at least I suspected it would be. So I went in with moderate expectations.
But you've not seen it before Ollie showed it to you. Well, myself, I'd not seen it either. I'd only ever heard the name. Occasionally, people mention it in a sort of one of those 80s movies that people used to watch as a kid or something. But fundamentally, I thought it was something like Red Sonja, or I didn't know anything about it. I didn't even know like Matthew Broderick was in it. I knew it was vaguely period drama action movie stuff, but not anything at all. And mainly reacted to the spelling having an E on the end for no reason and was going, "What's that about?" Does anyone know why it has an E on the end?
Well, it's just to make it look more medieval, isn't it?
They loved them E's at the end of words, did they?
They loved additional letters in general.
Yeah. I kind of thought the film should be called, like, Hawk Wolf or Wolf Hawk or something, because that would sound kind of quasi-comic booky or something. That would kind of get younger viewers watching it or something. But that's just me. Let's just talk about the film then, guys. Yeah?
Okay.
Okay.
We open with some rather cheesy 80s synth music. It's like a score over like a sunset and setting the tone. And the tone is very weird, do you not think? What did you think of the weird like 80s synth music score?
To whom are you speaking?
Both of you. One of you decide to speak first.
There are very few things I have a problem with this movie. But the music is one of them. It just, it pulls me out of it. And that's a shame, because I like it otherwise.
It's just odd, isn't it? I mean, I don't want to be critical early on, because we've not talked about anything of it yet, but it's just, I mean, it's the 80s, so obviously you're going to do things in the 80s style, but it does seem oddly different to all the other kinds of movies that would have a more traditional orchestral score. What do you think, Ollie?
I think it's, at the beginning, it is really incongruous, but the kind of synthy 80s-ness of the score does get toned down as the movie goes along, and so by the time you get to the end, it's not really noticeable anymore.
Yeah, I guess you either get used to it, or I think, like you say, it's less synthy as it goes on. It's a bit more traditional, but on certain action sequences, it does get kind of like, I don't know, 80s-ified and kind of a bit more modern for then, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, this score was pilloried at the time. It was ridiculed.
I just looked something up about the guy who composed it. He also composed music for Rockets Gibraltar and was the orchestrator for Triumphs of a Man Called Horse.
That sounds intriguing.
I just wanted to drop that in there.
Andrew Powell did the music, and I think I kind of know what they were doing with it, because what they were trying to do was mirror the progression of the movie from this really, really frivolous thing at the beginning to what turns into a really intense sequence at the end. And so you have a phase out of the synth music into a more traditional score, which kind of adds drama as you go on. But at the same time, the synth score isn't as bad as people say. It's just very incongruous.
It's the first thing that strikes you, and it's a very weird, like the opening does. It makes it feel cheaper than like the text they have of the actors' names and stuff over the sunset and the photos, like the footage of hawks flying and things. It's just, you just start to think, what is this? Like, it doesn't seem like a professional movie at first, but then once the characters are in it, you feel a little, you kind of go with it a lot more. But at first, I was very trepidatious when forming opinions early on this. But we haven't talked about who's in it, and who's in it as kind of the focal character is, I want to say Felipe something or other, but his name's Mouse, and he's played by Matthew Broderick. He's our focal character-ish. I mean, it's about three people, arguably, isn't it?
Yes, it's about Matthew Broderick, as you say, he plays Philippe. Gaston as Haven. Then we have Rutger Hauer as Captain Etienne Navarre.
Yes.
And Michelle Pfeiffer as Isabel d'Anjou.
And then we have,
sorry,
we have two kind of auxiliary characters who are both priests, who are Leo McKern as the monk, whose name I've forgotten temporarily.
Imperious,
and then
John Wood as the Bishop of Aquila.
The evil bishop.
I thought it was called Aqualung, to be honest. Like, I thought that's what they were saying, Aqualung.
Remember that all bishops have to be evil in 80s movies.
Yeah. Well, all bishops are fundamentally evil anyway. Ooh, I'm not slamming religion. Some bishops are nice, surely. But this is fiction, so it doesn't matter.
I can't think of the last time I ever saw a bishop that wasn't evil in something. Priests are nice in things, but bishops,
I don't know,
they're always bad.
It's the hierarchy system. The higher up you are in the chain, the more likely you are to be evil, just because that seems more poetic, I guess. Ah, who cares? There's an evil bishop, and it's quite a small cast, really. There's a few other characters in there, and there are, you know, extras and guards and stuff, but the core main characters are very few. Like, it focuses a lot on this pickpocket called Mouse, who is escaping from a prison when we come in through the sewers and stuff, isn't he? And he's just getting out, and that's kind of our starting point with Mouse. And he is mouse-like in his physicality, I guess. I mean, he doesn't have ears and a tail, but he's a scrambler, and he's little, and he's kind of feisty, I guess.
Yes, and he has a slightly dodgy, wandering accent, but you forgive him that.
Yeah, I was going to mention the fact that Broderick doesn't have the best grasp on the, like, British, medieval British accent. I mean, it doesn't even matter that it's medieval. It's more, hello, Gavner, hello. Like, it's a bit, what are you doing? Sorry? You know, I mean, but you can forgive it, because Broderick is so charming, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's just because it wanders a bit. Mm. That you notice it, because if he had just stuck to one thing the whole time, it wouldn't have been so bad.
Yeah, the odd word will, like, set the keen ear off, will be like, oh dear, what did you say it that way for? But, what I liked about Matthew Broderick's character of Mouse was he kept having conversations with himself / God, and he's kind of sarcastic in general, and he would just have these, like, chats with God a lot of the time that were quite funny, and I really liked that. Kind of started to win me over with the film. Was his just sarcasm and deals with God that he instantly breaks and then says, well, you made me that way, God, you know. Did you guys find yourself liking Matthew Broderick in this role?
Yeah, he was really... There was a strong chance that anyone else could have ended up being a bit too weedy or a bit too...
Just annoying.
Yeah, whereas he put it... nicely. There's something about Matthew Broderick that means it's okay to be pathetic.
Yeah, he's kind of, he's earnest and a little bit cheeky, but fundamentally just, like, likeable and charming.
Mm.
But anyway, as all escapees from prison, you know, they have to be hunted down by guards, and the bishop is not happy, because, you know, it just seems like in certain times of history and in fiction, bishops are in charge of the army and stuff. It's just, then it's not so much a king as the church are in charge, isn't it?
It's very much like the Three Musketeers, where you have two centres of power. You have the royal family and their centre of power, and then you have the Catholic Church in the country, who also have their own soldiers. And so it's very much a bizarre double leadership, really.
But not in this, anyway. At least it's not the focus. We literally have ourselves concerned with the bishop and his guards and his men. And
basically... Yes, the evil...
Sorry.
Sorry. Yes, the evil bishop of Aqualung.
Yes. So the guards have to chase him down, and we get our first sort of introduction to one of the other main characters, because he has to save poor Mouse from the guards. It's quite a good choreographed scene, really, between the guards... like a little village he escapes to, they're in disguise and they surround Mouse, and he sort of scurries underneath tables, climbs things, somehow just gets away from them at every turn.
It's one of my favourite fights, that one, because it's very, you could, he's thinking it through and doing things that make sense.
Yeah, like I wouldn't call it on its plausibility just because it's fun and lighthearted. It isn't, you know, at the end of the day, it's more of a family film than it is. I don't know, it's not gritty in any way, it's just sort of fun and lighthearted, but with an emotional core to it. I mean, it's not, I don't know, I'd find it hard putting it in any one genre of movie, really. But it is a fun scene.
No. That's the whole point, actually, because I kind of like that you can't put it in a genre.
Yeah.
I like movies which do that. But the action sequences are really well thought out, because you have that fight, and you have the big fight at the end, and... It's just, they're very seamless and continuous.
Mm.
Yeah, it's you know, there's an act to getting them so that they fall nicely in funny and plausible-ish, and not just dopey or badly filmed. They can so easily go like, oh, this is boring or dopey, and they are usually quite entertaining. But yeah, we get that interrupted just as Broderick's looking to be getting lynched, or, well, not quite lynched, but getting caught, and we get some crossbow bolts interjecting from the crossbow of, what's his name, Captain something or other? Some dude in a black coat, cape.
Navarre.
Yeah, his name is Navarre. And you've got Rutger Hauer playing the hero for once.
Yeah, what else is he known for, really?
Blade Runner. More recently, Hobo with a Shotgun.
Oh, yeah.
He was also, surely at some point, we're going to have to do one of his other hero roles, which is Blind Fury. As the blind karate sword fighting expert. But generally, he plays villains. He was in The Hitcher. Oh, The Hitcher was one of his big ones.
Yes, it was. I was trying to think of the name of that.
I can't say I've seen him in too much myself. A lot of the films he's in, I haven't seen. I've seen Blade Runner, but that's, you know, there was no, it's Rutger Hauer. It was just literally, oh, some dude in a cloak and he's got a crossbow. Cool. But yeah, so he turns up, saves the bacon of mouse, or the mouse of, yeah, no, saves the bacon of mouse. And they're forced into bonding because they kind of have to escape together, sort of. I mean, what really happens at this point?
Well, Navarre needs to get in to where Mouse just got out of.
The city of Aqualung, or whatever.
Yeah, so he basically takes him hostage in order to get him to guide him inside.
Yeah, because he's an experienced recent prison break. I want to say victim. You can't be a victim of a prison break in that way. What is he? He's just a clever thief who's managed to escape, so is helpful to Navarre. So, yeah, like you say, he sort of semi-kidnaps him for a bit. But they kind of bond and stuff over the course of the movie, so it's not too mean-spirited. The thing that's a little bit weird about this is there's quite a long journey aspect to this film. Like, they spend a lot of time in the wilderness, making camps and being together. And, I mean, stuff happens along the way, and we'll get into it, but there is just a lot of travelling happening throughout the movie.
Well, it is... Actually, now that I think about it, it is a road movie. Except it's a road movie where two of the three travelling companions can never meet.
Yeah. And
which is why Mouse is such a vital character, because without him, they wouldn't be able to talk to each other at all as kind of the group.
I love the way he lies as well. Usually he lies for them.
Ah, wait. Before you get into the lies, we should introduce the third person who is crucial to this element of the story. That third person is the weird hawk that turns into a woman that is with Navarre most of the day. And
yes.
I think just to get to talking about it, because it's the kind of the whole plot revolves around it, is Navarre by day is a man, by night becomes a wolf, and when he's a man, there's a hawk usually about him or around him, and that turns into a woman played by Michelle Pfeiffer, and they can never meet each other as humans or animals. They only ever, you know, switch. As it turns, am I making sense? I'm starting to not make sense.
Oh, explain the curse. So we'll explain the curse. Isabeau and Etienne Navarre were very, very madly in love. And because the bishop really, really loved Isabeau too, and when he discovered she was in love with the captain and not him, he just cast down into the pits of fiery evil and pulled out a curse so that they would each turn into animals, but they would only ever be... essentially, that he would turn into a wolf, but during the night, and she would turn into a hawk, but during the day. So they would never be able to be humans together at the same time.
It's a weird curse. I mean, the motivation, okay, a bishop fancies a woman, but it's a strange one. I mean, what if they'd have picked more difficult animals. Like, what if one of them had become a giraffe and the other had become a frog or something? I mean, you guys see any other animal combinations that might have been more interesting? Feel free to have a think. I know it's a tough question. I'll edit it so it looks like you're like, I got one.
A crocodile and a turkey?
It's a good job the crocodile and the turkey could never meet.
I got a soft spot for a bear. And it would have fitted the climate.
What would the other animal be? Hummingbird, or what would you have? Really, they could become the same animal and they'd never meet, so it wouldn't matter.
Look, it's a fairly horrible curse because they're doomed to be together, but not really together. It's kind of a taunting curse.
Yeah, it's the classic, you know, mess about some lovers curse where you doom them forever and make them very emo and sad. What goes with your bear app? What do you reckon?
Goose.
Fair enough. I mean, that's I mean, it would be pretty horrible if one of them turned into a fish. You'd always have to get to water at midnight. I mean, it's not practical. I mean, you know, we can't really question the curse. It is what it is. One's a hawk, one's a wolf. They can't ever meet. Boom. That's the premise, really. That's it in a nutshell. And like you mentioned, Mouse, who isn't a mouse, is literally just a man. He is the linchpin and the puzzle piece that is needed to solve their problem, really, because he's so critical to them solving this, and yet he's not really obliged, other than his life's been saved, to help them, really.
No, exactly. He's in a sense, he's looking for redemption as well, but he doesn't know it.
Yeah, so they're on the road together. It's very hard to explain how they bond, but basically, Mouse is there for Navarre, and Navarre is there for Mouse, and then when they switch, and Mouse is a bit confused by why suddenly there is a woman and a wolf, like, there's a wolf chasing him, there's a weird woman turned up, and it's all very confusing. You know, the people, I think they stay with, like, a couple of peasants who are going to betray them and, like, you know, hand them in to the bishop. And that's the kind of first time Mouse is discovering the weird switcheroo they do. Am I right on thinking that?
Yeah.
Yes. But he doesn't really understand it. I mean, the switcheroo is kept mysterious until halfway through, if you've looked at the poster or read the information or whatever, then you'll realise what's happening very quickly.
Yeah, it's sort of like, you can gather it quite quickly. I mean, it's not done in a overtly, it'll be a twist at the end thing. It's done in a, you don't know at this point, but, you know, think about it. I mean, you know, what else would it be? What else would be happening? But what did you guys make at this point where they've sort of explained it a little? They've shown you how are you finding, I guess, Michelle Pfeiffer's character and Amand Navarre or whatever? Abby, what about you? What did you make of them?
What I liked was that they didn't explain anything, and she actually spent quite a while being quiet at first, because other films would feel the need to really spell it out for people that this is what's happening. She is a hawk. He is a wolf.
Yeah. Well, I think the clues are there. Like, the fact that she's not scared of the wolf is a bit mysterious, and you're going, you should be thinking, oh, it's a bit weird. I mean, you know, it's there to say, oh, there's something odd going on, but fundamentally, you're right, it isn't to bludgeon you over the head kind of stuff.
I love a lack of exposition in movies. That always cheers me up, because you kind of, if everything is spelt out, then you don't really need to watch the movie anymore, do you?
Yeah, there is exposition towards the end. The monk does a lot of the, and let me explain it to you, Mouse, because, you know, you understand, you've got it. That happens later. But in a way, it is good that they just, you know, hit the ground running and go, oh, this is weird.
Yeah. And, yeah, starting in the middle of the story is always excellent, too. And we do. We don't start at the beginning. We start at the second act or whatever, which is what they normally tell you to do in a film, is, you know, if you don't have to do the boring beginning bit, then don't.
Yeah, we don't know Mouse's life, really. All we know about Mouse is he's a pickpocket and he likes chatting with God. But we don't know anything about him, and we don't really know who they are as people or animals, I guess. But we don't find that much out. All that is crucial, really, is that they have this curse and they loved each other once, and now they don't get to see each other but still hang out. But one is an animal all the time. So it's a weird little story. But Abby, you were going to say how you quite liked how throughout the film, as Mouse gets to know them, he sort of manipulates their relationship. Was that what you were going to talk about?
Yeah, because they don't see each other and they don't really feel comfortable talking about each other with him. He just makes things up and tells one that the other one said that they miss them and that they'd love to see them again, and vice versa.
He's like a little fake message to them from the other one. He's like a post-it note that he's made up for them. Oh, yeah, she said she loves you she loves you and stuff. Oh, yeah, he said he thinks you're beautiful and awesome.
Yeah, he's like a little marriage counsellor, isn't he? Which they probably need, because they've been wandering around for years, never seeing each other. So they've probably lost a lot of confidence in the fact that the other one even likes them anymore.
Yeah, when you just have a wolf accompanying you or a hawk on your arm, you kind of go, did I love you? I mean, I don't even remember you properly now. I know to love you, but do I? I mean...
It's more like, does she love me now?
Yeah, it's like they're separate, basically. Personality-wise, they never meet, so it's difficult. I get it, you know?
Yeah, Michelle Pfeiffer does fairly well in this movie, because really all she's called on to do is to look beautiful and ethereal, and she does that.
Yeah, for me, what's weird about it is the way that everyone refers to her, like she's like this amazing magical muse of love. Well, I think, what's the phrase they use? It's like, it was like looking at love itself or something. Like, it was just, really, guys, everyone falls in love with this chick? She's just an attractive woman as far as we know. You know, it's a bit strange how everyone's like, oh, yeah, but when you see her, you fall in love. Everyone falls in love with her a bit.
Whenever somebody new saw her, they all had that kind of, oh, I can't look at her. She's so beautiful.
Yeah.
Which
yeah.
is weird, but because everyone did it, then it's this, you kind of buy it.
Yeah, like with Mouse, he just sort of, he likes her, and maybe he does fall in love with her a bit. He sort of says he kind of fancies her a bit, but he doesn't overtly, like, I must betray the guy and run off with her. I mean, they kind of bond a bit and become friends as, you know, they spend time together, but it isn't, you know, a ridiculous thing. It's, you know, it's reasonable.
No, it's kind of, it's shades of the end of Inner Space where Martin Short is watching them get back together, and he knows that he just has to deal with it.
Yeah.
Shades of that.
I'm sure people will totally be like, oh, Inner Space, now you say it that way.
Well, they must have, because they must have listened to all of our podcasts.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
Assume.
Listener.
But yeah, you know, anyway, there's not really that many key parts to this movie that we need to go to and say, okay, there's the bit where, I don't know, they fell in the ice for a bit and it was all very scary, or, you know, the guards caught up with them at an ambush. It's kind of like, it doesn't have it has one goal, really, which is get to the bishop and for the knight, what's his name,
Navarre.
I want to say Jafar or something. But he basically wants to kill the bishop, and along the way, the solution to the curse is kind of... It involves a monk. I mean, I don't know where to focus, because basically they have one thing to do, and that's get to the bishop, kill him, and or break the curse. And it's just, they spend a lot of time running away from the guards, and that's basically all that happens, you know? So
well, there are two tracks. There's Navarre wants to kill the bishop, and then the mouse, after he's met the monk, who tells the whole story about the curse, wants to get into Aquila, but not to kill the bishop, to break the curse instead. Mm. So there's kind of two different tracks, and that's why the mouse lies a bit. And he's kind of like an unreliable narrator, but not to us, but to...
them.
Them.
Yeah, he's cajoling them into loving each other, and also sort of trying to convince them. Because he's kind of like, oh, I actually like this more optimistic break the curse thing. Maybe Mouse has a purpose suddenly, where he doesn't... He's bonded with them both, and he saved them a little bit, and he's been saved. So he kind of feels the need to intervene with their lives a bit and helps them, you know. But I guess the key point that happens for them in terms of plot carrying on and getting involved with the monk was they kind of get ambushed. Mouse kind of runs off at one point and goes and before he's made friends with them properly and gets caught, and then Navarre is also like caught by the guards, isn't he? And they get shot. Both the hawk and him get shot with arrows, and that's why they need to get to the monk, because once they escape, they still have an injured bird with a massive arrow sticking into it, and it's somehow still fine. And that's kind of why they seek the help of this mysterious monk in a ruin, isn't it?
Hmm.
Yes. That's why. And the monk was the guy who... yes, and the monk also has a story, because he was the one who drunkenly told the bishop about their confessions at one point and brought the curse down on them.
What a git.
He's very sorry, and he wants to make it up to them.
Yes,
the whole thing.
Yeah, it takes on a slightly, for me anyway, Monty Python and the Holy Grail feeling when the monk's involved, and it looks a certain way, and it kind of feels a bit like they're going to drop into sort of sketch characters and do like insults like involving elderberries and things. It's like, do you know what I mean, Ab? It's kind of, at times it just feels like, are we in Monty Python now? What's going on? It never really commits to that.
I think because of the kind of characters that Navarre and Isabeau.
That's her name, Isabeau?
Isabeau. Because they're fairly serious characters, Mouse has been able to be humorous on his own up to a point. Mm. So when he's with the monk, they add in a little bit more humour just to lighten the mood a bit before the big finish.
Yeah, because the monk's basically a bit crazy and, you know... obviously a friend of Navarre or something, or there's a history there, but he does have like booby traps and things set up so that people, when they come across the bridge to his ruined castle thing, they'll fall down, and like it's a little bit like you say, there's more levity, and it's a little bit, he's more of a funny character, the monk, isn't he?
Yeah, but he's basically a dramatic vehicle to get the film to its resolution. But yeah, he's played by Leo McKern, so he's going to be a bit funny.
What's he famous for?
He's famous for being an Australian character actor who did a lot of work in Britain. He played the barrister Rumpole for a long time on television. And that's pretty much it. Basically, he's a character actor, so he's popped up in lots and lots of things.
It does an all right job, though. He adds some life to the script, and like you say, the hawk lady and the wolf man are kind of a bit dry and serious a lot of the time, and injured. So it's like, oh, poor them. I mean, please save them. One of them has an arrow. Well, they both have arrows in, but it's more important that the bird is saved and stuff. I mean. And then there's, again, another transformation. And this is where Mouse finds out the backstory. I guess we do for the first time. And like you say, that kind of focuses them. And you know, there's still an element of doubt in the mind of... I can never say his name right.
Navarre.
Yes. There's still doubt in Navarre's mind. He's still, I'm just going to kill him. What are you on about? Day and night, night and day? Are you singing a song, you fool? Like, what's going on, isn't he, you know?
Mm.
But they do, they progress at the monk's request to the bishop. Well, they're heading towards the bishop. And it just so happens, in 3 days' time, some cryptic thing about day and night will come at the same time. And basically, the way to break the curse is... if the two lovers see each other as humans in front of... oh, if the bishop sees the two humans together again at some point, that curse will be broken. Is that right?
Yes. Essentially, if by some freak of circumstance they manage to stand in front of the bishop, human at the same time, it will be broken.
But of course, that could never happen, because it's never day and night at the same time. Unless in 3 days' time something's going to happen, but the monk won't explain what. He won't say, there'll be an eclipse. Think about it. Day and night. You'll be able to, you know. And he doesn't say that. Well, he just says, go, in 3 days' time, it'll be day and night at the same time.
But he doesn't really know, because what he's had is a message from God.
Oh, God, why is he so cryptic? If he just told us what he wanted.
Well, the whole thing is a message from God. I mean, Maris is really a message from God. He's sent to basically break the curse and defeat this evil bishop who's reached down to the pits of fiery...
Fieriness.
Fiery place.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I'm not sure if it was one of the missing chapters of the Bible, but maybe you're right. Maybe it has bigger... connotations about God and interference from the both sides of good and bad. But either way, they're on their way. It's all good for us because it means an exciting fight scene. Basically, Mouse uses his route back into the prison to get underneath the cathedral, which is where they want to get into. And he lets in, he kind of unpicks the lock and lets in the... Oh, we haven't mentioned the horse that Navarre rides, which is called Goliath. And now I have. Anyone want to say anything about the horse?
It was a wonderful horse. I'm not usually much for horses, but that one. I was about to say the horse is the man, but that doesn't make any sense.
Yes, we don't know. We got horse men and mouse men and wolf men and hawk women. It's all very confusing, Abby. So, but the horse is a horse. It's called Goliath. You know, it's just there to be a big, giant man black beauty, isn't it, really?
Yeah, a big showy movie horse.
Yeah.
Who can dance a bit and show off and intimidate people.
Yeah.
Quite happily. He's a great horse.
There's also a vague MacGuffin of a sword with jewels that are somehow significant to Navarre. And something about his dad did this jewel and the thing, and we got that jewel on this sword, and I need to jewel here. And it's all very, what's the sword jewel thing about?
Oh, it's just a quest, that's all.
That's just it. It's the token quest element where you have a thing you need to sort out.
Yeah, it's the family sword.
The family sword.
And he doesn't win at the end until the family sword gets returned to him.
Yeah, but it doesn't help in that. In the battle where the sword turns up, Mouse, I don't know, he runs away. Anyway, we'll get to it. Basically what happens is the fight breaks out in the cathedral on horseback against the head guard. It's all very dramatic, and it's, you know, what did you guys make of that? I mean, we've already mentioned the fight scenes are quite interesting. Ab, what did you make of this final climactic fight?
They had a horse in a cathedral.
That's not allowed, surely.
I thought that was bold.
You don't see it in every film.
I know, they kept it simple. It put me in mind of, I think it's Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where they had a fight in a church, something like that. And they used every single prop they possibly could during that fight. And it felt a little bit much. Whereas this one was a bit more restrained.
Yeah, there's a suspicious bit for me where the odd-looking helmet gets thrown up in the air and smashes out the little circular stained glass window so that it can conveniently show the eclipse happening later. But other than that, it was quite good. Ollie, what did you make of it?
No, it was a very good fight scene. There's a point somewhere in the fight scene where they go from a fixed camera to a steady cam, a handheld of some kind. They're called steady cams, aren't they?
Probably.
Can be.
And the wobbliness that suddenly comes in really makes it a very uncertain feeling fight scene. It adds a lot of tension to it.
It can often be difficult. Like, a lot of films botch up shaky cam type stuff, and I didn't feel angry and annoyed that I couldn't see anything when it was happening.
It's a good fight scene. It's essentially the end of the road movie. And they get to the end of the road and they reach the cathedral and they have this big fight. And there's inverted colours. Oh, yeah, there's inverted colours. So the good guy is in black and the bad guy is in white. And I never noticed that until the last time we watched it. And there's lots of inverted kind of themes going on. But the fight is most notable for the fact that it leads into one of the two very raw moments of the film, because there are two really raw emotional bits. There's one where Navarre and Isabeau happen to be looking at each other when they are transforming. So there's just a moment when they're almost together at the same time.
They very nearly touch, and then can't.
Yeah,
and can't.
There are. That's an interesting thing we haven't really talked about. Is the transformation element of any transformation movie is usually something to talk about. In this, we don't see too much. Maybe that's a good thing. We wouldn't want it to be too, like, horrific, mutating. You know, it would be kind of gross if they, like, did the classic werewolf and Hawkwoman. Well, there's no classic Hawkwoman thing, per se. No offence, Hawkwoman, if you're listening. But transformation scenes in this are fundamentally just... they're just, like, they fade in and out. I mean, how would you describe it, guys? I mean...
Well, you don't really see transformation scenes. I mean, you see Isabeau turn into a hawk, basically... her eyes change. There's lots and lots of light, so I guess it's overexposed.
They fade imagery over what, like they overlap images of a hawk over a woman, and it's kind of, it's not really, it's just implied. It's not so much shown, is it?
No, it's not.
They sort of do it from point of view by doing the close up of the eyes, and I think there's something else, maybe a close up of hands or something.
Yeah.
But giving you a sense of what it felt like happening rather than what it looked like happening.
And that's kind of what you want to do, because this is not a fantasy movie, really.
Yeah, it's light. There's no orcs or anything. It's sort of meant to be medieval England, more or less.
And once you start doing explicit transformations and things, it would rob from the drama.
I guess.
And also,
so.
it would tilt the balance over into being a totally different kind of movie, which you don't really want it to be.
Yeah. Mm. For me, they're a little bit cheap and rubbish. Like, as a thing, it's like, really? I mean, it doesn't really do it for me, but I get why. And I think I agree with you as to what you're saying. I just think, it's a bit silly when it happens for me.
Yeah, and the other raw moment is the confrontation at the end, but carry on.
Yeah, we'll come back to that, I think. I have one more thing I wanted to mention, and then we'll go back to the end where we were talking about. Another thing that I thought was a bit weird to do with the transformation is they have that scene where they're up a tower, at the ruins, I think, where the monk is, and the guards have come, and, oh no, they're on the tower and they're fighting, and, oh no, she's falling and dangling, and she falls just as the sun comes up or down or whichever way it's going, and turns into a human, or no, from, it would be awful if she turned into a human and fell from the sky. As she's falling, she becomes a hawk, and it was just, really, you wouldn't just half transform and hit the ground. What did you guys like, the falling from the tower thing?
It was very nearly there. I could have done, I don't know, with maybe a few more transitional frames or something.
It was just a bit too, really. You could see it coming, I think, is the problem I have.
Maybe. But I there's nothing wrong with the idea of it for me.
Yeah.
It's just, I would have done it slightly, I would have made a slightly different choice, maybe. But the principle of it is fine.
What about you, Ollie? What do you make of that little bit?
It's a bit predictable it's going to happen because they get to the top of the tower. And while you're watching it, you're thinking, oh, Philippe, you're running away from these guards. And, oh, you're climbing all these stairs. You're probably going to end up at the top of the tower, aren't you?
Yeah.
And be trapped. What can possibly happen then?
One of my favourite quotes from anything is from a version of Oliver Twist where when they're trying to escape, Fagin says, never go up. You're just going to get trapped. Why would you go up?
Good advice.
And they get forced up anyway, and he's complaining the whole time because going up is a terrible idea and people shouldn't do it.
Yeah. I mean, pickpockets know their stuff. I mean, you know, you've got to pick a pocket or two, and Mouse knows that, and he does all right. Mm-hmm. There was something else along on the road. I didn't quite understand the bit with... Dr. Octopus is called in, is he not? The guy who plays Dr. Octopus in Spider-Man 2.
Alfred Molina.
He is a sort of scruffy-looking henchman that's dispatched, but he doesn't have much going for him, really. He's sort of meant to be an intimidating threat, but doesn't he get punched into a bear trap or something?
He's a wolf catcher, but that's the best thing to be in order to
catch a wolf.
Get rid of Navarre.
But he fails... after lots of wolves, you know, get caught. I mean, what was the... he was just a sort of medium-level threat. I thought he was going to be a bit more of the evil henchman, you know?
Well, no, he was just he was a wolf catcher. If he doesn't catch the wolf, then that's it. He's not an evil wizard or anything. He's just a guy with some wolf traps.
Yeah, he's a scruff and a bit of a git. And I guess that's why he was dispensed in such a brutal way.
It felt a little bit more literary in that way, because villains in books tend to be more of a threat as an idea than as an actual presence.
Perhaps. But anyway, I when he was introduced, I was suspecting he was going to be the final battle. But I guess if he just was a wolf catcher, it's less interesting. And it's the head guard who's been kind of put upon the whole time by the bishop and blamed for everything and not doing his job properly. And he's the kind of final proper battle in the cathedral, as we were talking about, isn't he? Does anyone know about the guy who plays the head guard or whatever? He looked familiar to me, but I couldn't place him.
Stalling.
Ken Hutchinson?
He did actually remind me of somebody, too.
Who's that guy, Ab? We saw singing... Oh, it was just me, Blast. I think I was watching Nevermind the Buzzcocks, and they showed a clip of a guy singing with a... Oh, it was this week's at Buzzcocks. No one else saw that.
It is Ken Hutchinson.
Ken Hutchinson. Okay.
He was in Gandhi.
Good for him.
Oh, Hamish Macbeth. Or The Bill. I don't know what you would have seen him in.
Possibly The Bill. Classic, boring British cop movie. Not movie. Classic British grubby police TV show.
Police soap opera, essentially. Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, he wasn't much of a big final villain, really. He hadn't had that much, you know... He didn't have any gravitas or importance, really, did he?
No, he's just a tough-looking soldier type.
He was a bit too down-to-earth as an ending, in a sense, because it's like, yeah, well, the head guard will fight him, not all the other guards. And the other thing that was weird about this fight, right, was, like, all the priests were there for a special mass or something, but they all just stood in a line, watching everything unfold, but doing nothing. Did you guys not think it was weird there was just priests just standing there watching as background dressing?
That was a little bit odd, actually, now that you come to mention it. They just let all this stuff unfold. But then again, I put it down to they didn't like the bishop either.
But they didn't flee or do anything. They literally just stood there emotionless.
Well, yeah, that's kind of the way it works, I think. If any of them had spoken, they probably would have had to pay them more money. But they could have moved around a bit, I guess.
Just done something. I don't know. Like,
just cower. Cower a little bit.
Navarre just run past all of his guards who he used to be in charge of. It's maybe implied that the guards let him fight rather than... You know, they could have stopped him in a way, but he kind of just charges through before he's let
him
into the cathedral.
That was one little bit of exposition I would have liked, actually. It was just a little bit clearer as to Navarre's relationship with the other guards.
Yeah, it needed it, didn't it?
He was a captain, we don't know too much about it.
It was kind of implicit that the bishop and the new captain were kind of the only things that had changed since Navarre was the captain.
Mm.
Yeah. But, you know, this good fight scene that happens, more or less fine and dandy, apart from the odd thing here and there. And, you know, the guard is defeated thanks to Mouse throwing in a sword, him not using it, but then just rolling craftily over the other guy's sword. It was just kind of like, you have the family sword, and it wasn't that helpful. But you've won, so never mind.
It was very helpful, because he got to do one of his signature sword-throwing moves with him.
Right at the end, but he could have done that anyway. Like, so the bishop sees them, basically what's happened is, the monk has the bird, and lets the bird... presumably when transformed into a woman at the perfect eclipse moment, sends her in so that, you know, they can be together and witness together in front of the bishop. And Navarre's like, look at us. Don't close your eyes, because I will run up and stab you again. Or at all. Look, me. Her. me, her, together, look at us. Mm, boom, done. Right?
Yeah. It's a very raw moment.
I didn't do it justice, in fairness.
I think perhaps just the tiniest bit of special effect, just maybe a glow or something, just to let me know that it worked.
Just a twinkle and a thumbs up in the clouds from God. Bing!
But you just have to rely on trusting Liam McCurd when he says it's over.
Yeah, you have to, because otherwise you're going to be standing around looking at your, you know, sundials going, are we good after the eclipse? Now the eclipse is over, we're officially both staying as humans, right? There's not going to be like a weird Shrek thing where we both become animals permanently or something, you know.
Oh, it's not going to be really strange. We both turn into animals at night and stay human during the day.
Yeah.
It's not going to be strange, is it?
No. Maybe they both become ogres. So there's that chance that it hasn't worked, because there's nothing, like you say, to definitely go, well, apart from the monk going, it's good, it's good, I can tell. There's like an aura about you now. You're both human permanently, I can tell.
I think they can probably tell as well. They can feel
it. I feel less wolfy. I feel it inside. I feel like I don't have to kill voles anymore to survive. Yeah, good. But, like you say, he uses that sword, the bishop, classic evil bishop move, where just as you think he's defeated, he's going to go, I'm going to have another crack at killing you, because you can't be together, because I love you and stuff. And he attacks him with his scepter?
I think it's staff. A pointy evil bishop staff.
Some bit of Catholic pole-age.
I think that was bespoke myself to that bishop, because that doesn't look like anything I've seen.
Oh, they like some weird knickknacks, but, you know, maybe it was weaponized slightly, but he doesn't get to use it, because, like you say, he got a sword thrown at him, and is, mightily taken out in a spectacular bit of sword throwing, because, you know, why not?
Which Navarre couldn't have done with another sword, because I guess you really have to know the balance of the thing that you're throwing.
Of course, but that makes perfect sense. What's the thing with the jewel? Does he get a jewel? What's the thing? The sword must be rewarded in some way with its missing jewel thing.
Well, it's an honour thing, so once he's completed the quest, he will put a jewel in there.
Ba 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 ba! Like that. He'll just light up above his head like in Zelda or something. He'll get one.
That might have been nice as maybe over the credits or something. Just having a jewel put into the sword.
Yeah.
I just need a full stop.
Bit of crazy glue on the back of a plastic, plastic tat. Stick it on. There you go, son. You're complete. Now go get married, you crazy kids. But it basically.
And don't.
Sorry, go on.
And don't talk to any creepy bishops on the way.
For goodness sake, stop making people fall in love with you and be super jealous. But it does have kind of a sort of nice semi-romantic ending where they hold each other and go, everyone goes yay, and Mouse and the monk that we've met have come up and they go yay, and basically the monk and the boy go off hand in hand into the sunset, and there's a few funny jokes passed between them, and we're left to witness all the priests just staring at the couple in the church surrounding them, the sun sort of beautifully just finishes being eclipsed. You know, it's trying to say, hey, look, a happy emotional ending. But I did feel like, well, okay. I just was like, that's good then. What did you guys make of the finale, or the very end?
I liked the end in principle. But it was weird that all of the priests were just standing about gawking. But I'm not going to mark it down for that very much, just maybe one or two.
Ollie?
I like the ending. I mean, I like the film. If it helps, I think it helps to imagine the fact that maybe these priests saw two or three other incidents in this story before the film began. And now they're just there thinking, oh, you remember when the bishop went crazy?
Yeah.
And all that fire appeared when he was making that curse.
Yeah.
This is kind of the end of that. Let's have a look.
Maybe we could
together. Let's have a biscuit.
Either that, or the whole time they're just thinking, I know this guy. What's he from? Where's he from? I know his face. Oh, it's going to bother me now. who's this guy?
Is that Matthew Broderick? Oh, my goodness. Isn't he in The Producers? Oh, not yet. That hasn't happened.
Look, the jerky bishop's died. No, how should I react? Should I react sadly? Should I be happy? Maybe just kind of quiet respect for the dead.
Oh, I've got to get his autograph. I want to be part of Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Maybe I can get cast in that if I ask him nicely.
And look at the happy lovers.
Yeah.
We're Catholics. We're Catholic priests, blast it. Look at them. Let's be miserable inside.
Well, we can only speculate and have at what the bishops would be, what the priests would be doing. But that was kind of the film, really. We can give our final thoughts, and I'm struggling once again, as usual, to think of a preposterous rating system instead of having thumbs up or stars, because we don't do it that way on Spoiler Filled. But anyone rating system for this particular film?
We can have mythical animals.
Yeah, why not? Why not? Abby, why don't you sum up your thoughts and maybe give us a mythical animal that this movie is?
Okay. I was going to suggest something different, but I can do mythical animal, it's fine.
What were you going to suggest?
Filmic transformations in other things.
Run with whatever you want.
I like Lady Hawk.
Sorry.
It hits most of its marks. The music does bother me a bit, but I still understand that it's a well-made film, and that's just my personal taste.
Sure.
So, and there are definitely things about it that it doesn't make sense to the casual listener for me to say I would recommend bits of it to other people, but I mean in the sense that there are things that you can learn from this movie.
There's things to like, but it's not altogether perfect. I mean, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but I like it.
Sure.
And I would say that the mythical animal would be... I don't know that many mythical animals.
Well, there's the duckbill platypus and the push-me-pull-you and the Bigfoot. Platypuses don't exist,
do they?
Come
back to me for the mythical animal. Come back to me.
Okay, we'll come back to you. But platypuses, that's a myth, right? They don't exist. Because that's what I think this film is. I think it's a platypus. Maybe it's real, but I don't know. This beaver tail, duck face, what are you talking about? What's going on? That doesn't exist, does it? Nah.
You must do.
But this movie, yeah, I think it does. But it was thought to be a hoax. And I think in a way this movie is kind of, like, it is rightly represented by a duckbill platypus. Because there's a lot to like. It's a bit confusing, and it's a bit odd. I like it. I really like duckbill platypuses. Probably not as much as I like this film, but it's unusual and weird, and yet at the same time likable. That's my animal of choice. I would say of Lady Hawk, though, because my metaphor isn't working. I did more or less like it. Similar to Abby, I liked bits of it. I thought other bits weren't quite realised as well. I think it suffers a bit from, I don't know, maybe a budget problem. I'm not sure. The locations weren't too bad. I don't know. It's just not quite at the standard. It's not like Game of Thrones or something. It's not that kind of quality mixing medieval with fantasy. But, you know, it was the 80s, different sort of kettle of fish. I don't know. I don't love it. I don't hate it. What about you, Ollie? Have you got final thoughts on this thing?
Yes, I have some final thoughts. I like this movie. It's interesting, and it kind of fits into my little big thing, because I only seem to like movies which are kind of a mix of either big stories and little character moments, or essentially there's a big myth story going on, and also there's a small character story going on, and by mixing them together it makes me interested, whereas I lose interest in movies which are only big.
Like something like Lord of the Rings, is it just a bit too epic for you, perhaps? something like that. Is that what you're on about?
It's not really intricate. I mean, a better example is Avatar, which is all big, with no kind of intricate character story.
Sure.
But that's one thing, and also, Rutger Hauer gets to be the hero.
Yay! Well,
kind of. And there was one more thing. I kind of the escalation as the film goes on. I like minimalistic special effects. That's a thing I'm very happy with.
Mm.
And oh yes, the context. So, in the context of Richard Donner, after he did Superman, which was a huge film, and he was filming for what, 2 or 3 years on Superman.
Mm.
Because of all the special effects. And after that, he did a string of smaller movies. And this kind of comes. This is, what, the fourth movie after Superman?
Sure.
And it comes in between The Goonies and Lethal Weapon. I just think it's very interesting.
I think it is interesting that this comes between Goonies and Lethal Weapon as well.
Yeah, and he directed them all, is what I'm trying to say. So I like him. He makes interesting films.
I think, for me, Broderick is the best thing in it. And it's early Broderick, but I think his character, not so much his accent or anything, but just he's just funny. Like, I like the way he is. I think he's key to both the film and the relationship between Lady Hawk, who gets her name just because he thinks of calling her that. But yeah, I think he is key to me liking this at all, really.
Yeah, and he's kind of... He's not just talking to God, he's trying to schmooze or con God.
Yeah, it's a lot more underhanded and funny, yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of the thing with him. So, if he's kind of insurance praying. Well, he's not even praying, he's just kind of having imaginary conversations with God, in which he happens to also be trying to fool him, trick him, and con him.
He's like some sort of character in a computer game or something. He strikes me as something like a character from, like, Monkey Island or... Like a kind of adventure game. He seems like that kind of funny computer game character that you'd like being with on your own and being him, you know?
Yeah, he's a very well-defined character, and really it's his film, because he's the only crucial character in the whole thing.
Yeah. But yeah, so have you got a mythical animal that sums up this movie?
I've got no idea why. It strikes me as being quite centaur-like.
Half man, half animal, very apt.
Yes, that works. Excellent.
That doesn't really sum up the movie in a metaphor, but it's a film of good and bad. I don't know. What are you trying to say?
It's
a centaur-ish. I think it explains itself.
Partly funny looking, partly powerful. You're not sure what it's going to do. And overall, it's just... a very strange thing, as you will agree, that a centaur is.
Yes, it is a shade unplausible, but sure, I'll run with it. I like that, yeah. Do you have one, Ab? Have you thought of a mythical beast or animal or whatever?
Yeah, I'll go with what I've managed to think of. But it's a mermaid.
Okay.
Where your first instinct on the idea of a mermaid is, oh, ooh, interesting. But then you start to think about the practicalities of it.
Sure.
And you sort of have to suspend your... I don't know what the word is I'm looking for.
Logic, sense, disbelief.
If you want... not if you want to believe in mermaids. I don't know how to say this. But with Lady Hawk, if you're willing to buy in to elements of it, you'll enjoy it and like it. But if you can't buy into it, then you won't.
You can't be too cynical. And with a mermaid, it's nice to fall in love with the idea of them and indeed in love with them and crash a ship on the rocks. Unless they're the top half fish, that's just weird. But I kind of get what you're saying. If you go, oh, mermaids, and you like that, you know, people really love the mythology of the mermaid. And I think, you know, a cynic would be like, oh, it doesn't make sense. Why would... fish are the perfect design for the sea. Why would being part human be any use underwater? Is that the kind of thinking you're using?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, we've once again fumbled a rating system that no one will fully understand and come to the conclusion of our podcast. So unless you guys have any further revelations, we should bid the listeners adieu. Or adieu, or however you say it in French.
I don't know how you say it in French, but we should do that.
Yes. Ça va, salut, goodbye, baguette, I don't know. Time to go. Bye.
Bye.